That's right. You can't say yes while you're waiting for a cure. There you go. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a great show today, actually. At the back end of the show, I'll be airing an interview that I did earlier this year with Kate Morgan of No More Deaths about an important, powerful, and disturbing report on immigrant deaths in the borderland north of the U.S.-Mexico border. And before that, we'll be hearing the trailer from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. Now, that's a film of a recent speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. There has never been a film like this on this subject until now, and it premieres online on October 19th. At the back end of the show, I'll be airing an interview that I did earlier this year with Kate Morgan of No More Deaths. And before that, we'll be hearing the trailer from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution, the film of a recent speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, there's never, ever been a film like this on this subject until now, anywhere, okay? And it premieres online on October 19th. And in addition to sitting your own butts down to watch this film and think about it and talk to your friends about it and spread word about it, actually try to get as many people as possible to be tuning in to RevCom.us on October 19th to watch the film themselves and spread it to their friends and all over the country, all right? That's what we need to be doing these days. This is the kind of thing that people need to be talking about, struggling over, and it's the kind of thing we need right now. Opening the show up, however, I'm really pleased to be bringing you Annette Klapstein and Emily Johnson. They're the valve turners, all right? You've heard of the valve turners? They close the valves on pipelines in Minnesota that carry tar sands oil into the U.S., a direct action to shut down fossil fuel production and halt the destruction of the only livable planet that we got. You got that? Let's repeat that. To stop the destruction of the only livable planet we've got. A judge dismissed the charges before the trial. At the trial, they plan to defend their actions as necessary to save human civilization. That doesn't sound very important, does it? Yeah. All right. And Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Annette, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Sure. And let me just say real quick, Annette, is it Klapstein or Klapstein?
I say Steen. Half the family says Stein. I'll answer to either.
We could make a song out of that. We ought to go with that. All right.
Yeah, there we go.
All right. And that is a retired attorney for the Puyallup tribe and member. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And member of the Raging Grannies. Okay. And she believes that our current economic and political system is a death sentence to life on Earth. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. And that she must do everything in her power to replace these systems with cooperative, just, equitable, and love-centered ways of living together. And Emily Johnson is a poet and a co-founder of 350Seattle.org. She has said that for years, we've tried the legal, incremental, reasonable methods, and they haven't been anything like enough. Without a radical shift in our relationship to this, things aren't going to change, all right? So both of you, welcome. Emily, welcome. The rest of you, it's really...
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's really good to have you on. So let's jump into this right away. Let's go with Emily first. Emily, on October 11th, 2016, there was an action that you and, you know, both of you were actually involved in this, and then we'll have your comments on in a minute, but that you actually pulled together this action that was meant to break something out into the air in a big way. What was that? Explain to people what you did and why.
So what we did, Michael, was together with three other friends who were turning valves and with several friends who were acting as support people and videographers, we shut down all of the major tar sands bitumen pipelines into the United States. So Annette and I shut down two pipelines owned by Enbridge that were in Minnesota. Our friend Michael shut down the original Keystone pipeline in North Dakota. Our friend Leonard shut down the Spectra, it was called the Spectra pipeline in Montana, and our friend Ken shut down the Trans Mountain pipeline in Washington State. And we did that because, you know, tar sands is the worst of the worst when it comes to oil, the dirtiest form of oil there is. It's the thing about which former NASA scientist James Hansen said it is game over for the climate if we develop the tar sands.
Mm-hmm. And Annette, what was with you? You were involved in that as well, right?
With Emily in Minnesota shutting down the two Enbridge pipelines.
Now, what brought you there?
What brought me there?
Yeah.
desperation to have a livable climate for my children and all future generations. Mm-hmm. We are at such a dire place when it comes to what's been done about climate change compared to the effects that it's already having around the world. Thousands of people are already dying, and the IPCC report made clear that it could be hundreds of millions of people dying as early as 2040 from the effects of climate change. So this is absolutely morally unacceptable to me, and I cannot stand idly by and watch that happen without doing everything in my power to stop it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, Emily, tell me this. You were responding to a request for action in solidarity with Standing Rock, with what went on with Standing Rock. Tell us about that somewhat.
Well, you know, to be perfectly honest, we definitely would have done this action regardless. It seemed absolutely essential to us to do something like this, but we did choose the timing in order to be respectful to the call for direct action from Standing Rock. So, yeah, and I had been there, you know, about a month and a half before, and, you know, we were trying to figure out how to most be aligned with what was happening at Standing Rock and not in any way try to overshadow it, but to work in concert with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, Annette, you know, there was a whole question of, when we were talking about actually just now standing in solidarity with Standing Rock, but there was also a point where you guys actually said, look, we are going to tell these people, we are going to tell the people that are running all this, that are destroying the planet, we're going to warn them, but then we're going to go ahead with this. Talk about that. When you came, because that's a big decision to make, you know, it's sort of like, you're sort of like giving them, okay, do it or pay the price.
Yeah, we made safety calls. Basically, we wanted to do this, but we wanted to do it in the safest possible way. And we knew that the safest possible way was to get them to shut down the pipelines remotely. This action of shutting down pipelines had been done before in Canada. That's where we got the idea. Several people have done it several times up there. But, you know, we wanted this to be very safe. And so we had somebody in Seattle call the pipeline companies 15 minutes before people were scheduled to arrive in each state. And then we each had a support person on site who called the pipeline company again 5 minutes before we were going to turn it down. So, you know, we had it all staggered 15 minutes apart. So there would be, you know, plenty of time to do this. So, yes, you know, it was go ahead and shut it down remotely, or we are now cutting the chains and we'll go in there and, you know, turn the wheels and shut off these emergency safety valves.
Mm-hmm. So it was actually do it or we're going to do it. So that's it. So that was kind
exactly.
Of, yeah, very,
yes.
Very important. Now, you guys shut down 15%, if I'm right on this, that you shut down 15% of U.S. crude oil imports, which was almost a whole day of their crude oil imports. What was the impact of that?
Well, in the immediate sense, there was no impact to people because they have plenty backed up in mm-hmm. Plenty of supply in storage. But the impact to them was quite dramatic, both in terms of delayed profits and in terms of just waking up to the fact that people are going to fight these pipelines and that we are going to do everything we can peacefully and nonviolently to shut down tar sands operations, because we know, you know, tar sands is one of the projects that in a 2015 study that delineated which forms of fossil fuel we cannot, which projects we cannot engage in and still have a stable climate. Tar sands was one of those things. And they said by 2020, we have to have, quote, negligible, end quote, extraction of the tar sands going on. And instead, they're trying to build new pipelines. They're trying to ramp it up. It's totally crazy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also called. Go ahead.
I was just going to say their share price dropped the next day fairly dramatically.
Yes.
And, you know, that is the only thing they care about, and that is what gets their attention. So if we did this more, it would have, I think, a very significant effect.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also...
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Michael.
That's all right.
I was going to say, the internet is absolutely right. And what that also means is basically, you know, this is a very similar fight in some ways. They're all quite similar to the Shell No fight that we had in the Northwest against Arctic drilling. And by that, I mean that the companies get taken by surprise when there is massive public opposition. And the way you create massive public opposition is to educate people about why some projects are so much worse than others, how urgent climate change is, et cetera. And people respond, you know, to actions like ours in exactly the way that Annette said, you know, that the share price goes way down, because all of a sudden people understand that the existing system is vulnerable and it's problematic, and people are beginning to wake up to that.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Annette Klopstein, who's a retired attorney for the Puyup tribe and a member of the Raging Grannies, and Emily Johnston, who is a poet and co-founder of 350seattle.org, and both of them actually basically did something that was really, really great and was really the world needs to see a lot more of this. When they stepped in and they said, nope, we're not going to settle for this kind of what's going on with all this oil and all the things that are going on, U.S. crude oil imports and all the things that's happening in the world in the name of all that and because of all that. And they said, we're not allowing this to go on our watch. We're going to step up and stop things. And that was an incredibly important thing. Now, you also called out Obama on this, right? Which I thought was pretty good and pretty interesting.
Yeah, we did. We mm-hmm. sent him a letter inviting him very strongly to keep those pipelines off, because if that was done, that would be a 15% cut in the oil use in the United States. And that is the magnitude of cuts we need to make every year in order to salvage a habitable climate for future generations.
Mm-hmm. And Emily, what was the upshot of that?
Well, sadly, no, that did not happen. They turned on the pipelines. They were on average closed for the day, basically. And Obama obviously never responded to our letter. We do know that it was brought to his attention or to the attention of the White House in the briefing that day. So it was a big surprise to everybody that it was possible for, regular citizens to do something like this and to disrupt the system in that way. And I think that was an important message to send mm-hmm. because, one of the things that we have to do if we're going to survive the climate crisis, we heard the IPCC report on Monday. They said we have at most 12 years at current, extracting at the current rate that we are and burning at the current rate. And we all know how unlikely it is that we're going to make that deadline. And it means, millions, if not tens or hundreds of millions of lives and many species and so forth, that we do make it. So we have to shake the system up. And one of the things we have to do in order to shake the system up is to get citizens to understand that we are giving our passive implicit consent when we allow these projects to continue. They have millions of miles of pipeline. They have, oil trains coming through all of our communities. There are trucks and et cetera that we can stop. So if everybody stands up and hundreds of people go to block the oil train tracks, or hundreds of people, go to, make sure that people don't get into work at a coal mine, or make sure, that they park themselves in their governor's office and refuse to leave, all of those things are important, and we need all of them now. People need to remove their consent from these projects.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us a little bit about what happened. You did end up going to court. You were arrested. You went to court. What happened there?
We had a very shocking week, the past week. We were supposed to start our trial on the 8th of October, and a few days before the trial, well, to backtrack, the judge had very surprisingly granted us the necessity defense. None of our other comrades who did this in other states were allowed that. That was appealed up to the Minnesota Supreme Court and upheld. So we were ecstatic that we were going to be able to go into court and present climate science. We had Dr. James Hansen lined up and a bunch of other local climate scientists, et cetera, et cetera. Well, 3 days before the trial, the judge suddenly issued an order saying he was not going to allow any experts to testify to climate change or civil disobedience, which was, of course, the heart of our case. So we were shocked by that and reeling from that and trying to rebuild our case, because the only people who could then testify to climate change was ourselves. And we went to trial on Monday. And on Tuesday, the prosecutor presented his very brief case, which consisted of the sheriff who arrested us and one Enbridge employee. And he basically showed that we had cut some chains and locks, which we never disputed. And at the close of the case, our lawyer, Tim Phillips, made a motion for judgment of acquittal, which is a standard motion that's made in every criminal case. And I, as a lawyer who practiced for 30 years, have never, ever seen that motion granted before. But our judge granted it, and in other words, found us not guilty without us putting on one bit of evidence, just on the basis that the prosecutor had not proved his case.
Mm-hmm. Now, Emily, just to back up a little bit, this climate necessity defense, a lot of people just don't know what that means. You were really surprised that you could actually mount that, propose it, and that was actually going to be the heart of the court case. What is the climate necessity defense?
Yeah, Michael, it's very rarely granted in this country, but it does, it emerges from old English common law. And it basically, the analogy people often use is, If you are walking by a burning building and you hear a baby crying, it is actually completely legal to go in and save that, to break and enter in order to save the baby. And so what we often say is that, you know, the world is on fire and all the world's babies are in it, and so we need to do this. And so the elements of the necessity defense are generally that the harm has to be much greater than the harm you're causing by breaking the law. It has to be imminent. You have to have no legal alternatives, and you have to have reason to believe that what you're doing is an effective way to address the harm. And so we had expert witnesses lined up for each of those facts, multiple ones, a couple for each. And we think it is absolutely incontrovertible that this is what is necessary right now, and that we have that none of the legal alternatives are sufficient. We engage in those legal alternatives all the time. People have been doing it for decades, you know, whether it's meeting with legislators or speaking up at hearings, writing letters, you know, having protests. Everything that we can legally do, people have been doing, again, for decades. It's not working, and we need it to work in the next year or two.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just thinking about this because this, all you guys were saying about the this is all occurring in the face of this growing understanding about what the actual danger posed to humanity is in the world today, as right. Shown in the United Nations, you know, new intergovernmental panel on climate change that we're referring to. And it really does emphasize the necessity for people to actually, one, look at what's happening, take the blinders off and act on it. And it's really important that what you folks did in the world today was extremely, extremely important, you know. And I think in terms of getting this out and getting people to understand that, you know, look, you were people that were, and the people that worked with you were people who were concerned about this, but you did something that, one, could have put you in a lot of jeopardy, could have ended you up in jail and, you know, for a long period of time or whatever. But it was basically saying that, look, we have to act. And when we act, it has to be commensurate with the truth of what's happening today. I mean,
the IPCC report, the word that it used, which is not normally a governmental kind of word, is that the change has to be transformational, the transformational change in our society. And we also know the IPCC is historically quite conservative, and actually the changes that we need are even more than they are saying that we need. But the most important point is simply that we can still have a huge impact now, and our window to have that huge impact is closing very rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to add to that, Annette?
Right. Yeah, I would just add that, you know, what we need is system change. You know, incremental changes are not going to do it. I refer back to Naomi Klein's book a few years ago where she, you know, said that, you know, you can have a stable climate or you can have capitalism, but you can't have both. And that's where we're at. Capitalism is going to kill us all, and we have to have a complete system change, and we have to, you know, have the people have a say in what these fossil fuel companies are doing, because they're going to destroy us all.
Now, there is some information that people really got to grab hold of in terms of what needs to be done, what we're facing and what needs to be done. And that's, you know, that's something that comes through all the way. And I was wondering, do you, you know, the other people who were part of this action in other parts of the country, that they actually, was this, you know, and I've been following, I have a friend, Jen Marlowe, who has actually been working around some of the people down south who are, you know, there's a big thing around an oil development down there, and it's going to just ruin all these people's lives and stuff. But there's all these things, like, do you see, like, in terms of, what do you see happening? Because it was really significant, one, you guys were able to do this, but then two, that you were able to use to a certain, even get in the front door, this whole idea of the climate necessity defense, but then the door gets slammed shut. But in all these other cases, what's happening with them?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we know that, for instance, people who were at Standing Rock, particularly the indigenous folks, are getting, you know, hit with huge sentences on felony charges. And we know that we were treated more gently because we're old white people. Older white people, in Emily's case, middle-aged white people, but I'm 66 years old, you know, and so is Leonard. And, you know, I keep saying that that's why old white people need to get out and do this, because we aren't as great at greater a risk. And, you know, we have to look at, you know, what we're leaving for our children, our grandchildren, future generations. That's our job. That's our job to protect them. And if we go to jail, we go to jail. If we get a felony conviction, we get a felony conviction. I mean, I went into this fully expecting to get a conviction and quite possibly to do prison time. It's not that I want to. Of course, nobody wants to do it. It's horrible. It's a horrible system. It ought to be abolished. But if that's what it takes to turn it around, then old white people need to get their butts out there and do it. Because for one thing, you know, we don't have jobs anymore. You know, if we're retired, we don't have to worry about having a felony conviction on our record. We don't have kids at home to support. And when the police do show up, they won't shoot us the way they will do to our young friends of color. So, you know, this is an important role that older white people can play in the movement. And I say it's our job and our duty to step up and do that.
Emily, you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, sure. I would say, I mean, I absolutely agree with Annette. And I would also add that this work is the most important work anybody could be doing right now. And that also brings a lot of joy. So it's not just about duty. It's also about the fact that when you are fighting for fighting for life on Earth and for the continuation of the human species, you know, there is a kind of moral clarity and a joy to that that is so, so important. And the people in this movement are amazing. And I would just recommend that everybody who's listening to this show get out there, talk to their neighbors, talk to their friends, and see what they can band together and do to make the kind of change that we need in order to have a livable world. Because, like I said, we have very little time left, but we do have some time left. And that is the most important message people can have, because I know that people get paralyzed by the scope of climate change and the threats that it poses to us. So, you know, whether we're saving, you know, some communities being able to live where they live now for a few extra decades, whether we're saving more species, whether we're minimizing the number of human deaths, all of those things are so worth fighting for, and we can still fight for them. So we have to, and it's beautiful work to do.
Absolutely. And is there a way that people can get hold of you and the folks that you work with?
Shutitdown.today. That's our website.
Shutitdown.today.
Right.
Okay, pretty good.
And we also have a Facebook page. It's Shut It Down Climate Direct Action.
Shut It Down
Climate Direct Action.
Climate Direct Action.
That's okay. The Facebook page. You can reach us on either of those.
Okay, great. All right, I want to thank both of you for joining us today. It's really, and let's stay in touch, because this is really one of the most important things people can be paying attention to in the world today.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Sure, definitely. Thank you both. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Annette Klapstein, who's a retired attorney for the Puyallup tribe and member of the Raging Grannies. And she believes that our current economic and political system is a death sentence to life on Earth, and that she's got to do everything in her power to replace these systems with cooperative, just, equitable, and love-centered ways of living together. And Emily Johnston, who is a poet and co-founder of 350seattle.org, and she said that for years, we've tried the legal, incremental, reasonable methods, and they haven't been anything like enough. Without a radical shift in our relationship to this, nothing's going to happen, and we need that radical shift. And I want to thank both of them for that. Again, people really, really need to, one, check out what's going on with this, but also think about the whole reasoning, you know, because they always try to tell us that, you know, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, you should modify things. Don't go too far. But actually, when you're dealing with the question of the survival of the entire planet on anything else that's on it, and that's both in terms of the kinds of systems you have as well as what they're doing to this thing, you got to stand up and pay attention. You got to decide what's right and what's wrong, and what are you going to do about it, all right? And in that spirit, I want to remind everyone of an important date. October 19th is the online premiere of the film of a speech by Bob Avakian, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. So here's the trailer for the film, which you can access from revcom.us.
Why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people? White supremacy, male supremacy, wars of empire, the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants, the destruction of the planet, why is this the state of humanity? There is one fundamental reason. The basic nature of the system of capitalism, imperialism that we live under, and the way, because of its very nature, it continually perpetrates and perpetuates horror after horror. And in fundamental terms, we have two choices. Either live with all this and condemn future generations to the same, or worse, if they have a future at all, or make revolution. An actual revolution does not mean trying to make some changes within this system. It means overthrowing this system and bringing into being a radically different and far better system. A revolution aiming not just to abolish oppression, exploitation, poverty, and misery in one country, but having as its fundamental goal the abolition of all this throughout the world, and the elimination of all borders and boundaries that erect walls between the different parts of humanity. Let's be honest. This is a difficult road, but there is no other way to finally put an end to the horrors that are continually brought forth by this system. And as hard as this is, it is possible if we go about it the right way, with the right outlook and approach, the right goals and methods, the right strategy and plan. So this is what I'm going to dig into through the course of this talk. Revolution is possible, and we have to go to work to make it real.
That was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the film was Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. Now, this can be seen on October 19th at revcom.us, and really, get your friends together, get everybody you know, tell people you don't know. Check out this film. It's the kind of thing we need in the air and in our heads right now. Now we're going to hear my interview with Kate Morgan from No More Deaths on their report on death in the borderland. This report calls attention to a significant, albeit underreported, outcome of contemporary U.S. border policing strategy and practice. The disappearance of tens of thousands of migrants and refugees in the expansive wilderness north of the U.S.-Mexico border. This process of disappearance is related to the much more thoroughly researched and reported deaths of thousands of border crossers since the 1994 launch of the U.S. Border Patrol's strategy of prevention through deterrence. These are words found in the opening paragraph of a brand new report that's just been issued called Disappeared: How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. And the report was issued by La Coalición de Derechos Humanos and No More Deaths. All right, and I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Kate Morgan. Kate works with No More Deaths, which was one of the groups, as I said, that participated in coming up with it and developing this whole new report called Disappeared: How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Your report, we're going to jump right into this because we have a lot to talk about. So your report.
Great.
Disappeared: How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. Let's give people a broad overview of the report, what it is, and what compelled the two groups that participated in making this report to issue it.
Sure. So No More Deaths, along with La Coalición de Derechos Humanos, started working on this report a couple of years ago while they were operating a missing persons hotline. So in 2015, they're operating a hotline where families of folks who had crossed, who had gone missing, could call to talk to someone about the whereabouts of their family member. In 1 year, they received almost 12,000 calls to the effect of, one of my loved ones has attempted to cross the border. I haven't heard from them. I believe that they have gone missing or they have disappeared. And we started hearing that language so many times, this language of disappearance. We knew that there was already a very strong narrative about the number of people who die while crossing the desert. We know that almost 8,000 people have died in the U.S. borderlands since the late 1990s. But what we hadn't heard very many people talking about was this crisis of disappearance that was happening in the borderlands. And so we decided to come together to write the report called Disappeared, How U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Feeling Missing Persons Crisis. The report itself focuses on three different tactics that happen in the field that contribute to the crisis of disappearance. The first portion of the report is called Deadly Apprehension Methods, and it focuses on U.S. Border Patrol's practices in remote areas, such as chasing and scattering groups that commonly result in the disorientation and dispersal of individuals into life-threatening terrain in the borderlands. Part two focused on destruction of the interference with humanitarian aid, and it looks at the vandalism and removal of life-preserving humanitarian aid supplies by Border Patrol agents and details law enforcement's routine harassment and interference with humanitarian aid work in the southwest border zone. And part three, which we are working on right now, is going to look at emergency non-response. So the discriminatory lack of emergency responses for undocumented people who initiate a 911 call, and it's either not answered or it is answered very late and results in the disappearance of migrants in the borderlands.
Mm-hmm. Give people a sense of the numbers of people that we're talking about here.
Of the numbers of people who are crossing?
Yes, crossing, and the numbers of people who disappear.
Oh, and the number of people who have disappeared. So we really, it's hard to say how many people are disappeared. We know, for example, again, that this number of about 8,000 people's remains have been found in the borderlands since the late 1990s. And some experts think that for as many as 10 times that number of people have been disappeared. And so it's really hard to tell because the disappearance is a reference to people whose remains are never found or who are never accounted for in detention facilities. We can't find them in hospitals. They actually just completely go disappeared by the border itself. And so it's really hard for us to give an exact number. But we believe that it is a crisis of thousands and thousands of people.
Mm, boy. You know, one of the things in terms of, we talk about the numbers of people, but what about who these people are? I really want people to get a sense of the humanity of these people. Like, so who are they? If you can help us out with that, you know, give people a sense of who these people are and what actually compels them to try and cross the border on foot. Because crossing the border on foot has to be something that's pretty daunting when you first think about it. And it's, you know, it does seem to be, or is it? Is this a new development, a newer development in terms of people coming into the country on foot?
Yeah, so this question about who are we seeing cross the border or who are we seeing who has disappeared, I guess I would really encourage listeners to think of who are their neighbors and who are the people who are their coworkers and the people who take their kids to school, because the population of folks who are crossing the border is not a monolith, and it's honestly a lot of people who probably we may never guess that are a part of our lives already. Certainly, we already hear the stories of people who are fleeing violence in Honduras. That's a country that political and economic stability can be directly attributed to intervention by the U.S. government and the coup in the late 2000s, well, the 2009. We see people who are fleeing because of gang violence in El Salvador and Guatemala, and we see people who are leaving simply out of poverty. I hear people say, I can't feed myself and my family, and that's why I've decided to make this journey north. We're looking right now, in this current moment, we see the caravan of folks from Central America who have arrived at the Tijuana-San Diego port, and our asylum seekers asking for entrance and being denied. You know, we can see examples of many people who are attempting to cross the border. And I think it's really important for people to remember that the act of crossing a very, very deadly border is a great act of love, actually, that people don't leave their communities and their homelands, their families, without without some reason of love either propelling them forward or drawing them to this, to the United States. And so I guess that's the, from my standpoint, that's sort of the narrative that I want people to be thinking about, is that people are making the most dangerous journey of their life to make it even to this border, and then this border itself is quite deadly, and it's the, simply just the people who live around us already who are being forced to cross through those borderland regions.
Mm-hmm. One more question before we jump into the report itself. The category of disappeared, and you've used this term a lot, and it's a lot in the literature, the category of people disappearing and just the use of that term disappeared. Why this word?
Yeah, so we very intentionally chose the language of the disappeared, one, to be able to reflect the language that we were hearing in family members who are making the calls to the hotlines, but also to be able to connect it to other movements who have used that language to describe the violence, the state-sanctioned violence of disappearances. So many people might be familiar with that language as it appears in Argentina or Chile, maybe even in Central America. We wanted to connect to these other historical moments that people could easily point to and say, actually, yes, that was the machine of the state was part of this crisis of disappearance, because that's the exact same thing that we see happening on the border, that the U.S. government is creating policies and placing infrastructure and militarizing the border that then leads to the crisis of disappearance. And so to be able to connect the language of this moment to the language of historical moments where that has happened as well felt very important to us.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's jump into the report itself. The report's going to be, as you said, it's going to be released in three parts, but two have already come out. So let's start talking about them a little. The first is deadly apprehension methods. Let's talk about that, daily and deadly policing practices.
Sure. So when we say deadly apprehension methods, we're referring to a number of on-the-ground tactics used by Border Patrol agents themselves. One method that we see a lot of and that we hear a lot of people talk about is called chase and scatter. So chase is the active period of pursuit of Border Patrol agents when they attempt to catch or catch up with individuals or a group in order to apprehend them. And scatter refers to when individuals are separated from their group due to Border Patrol intervention and dispersal into the wilderness. So we see this happen a lot with helicopters when we're in the field, actually. We'll see helicopters that are in pursuit, we believe to be in pursuit of a group, and they will actually come down very close to the earth and scatter a group. What the scattering actually leads to is people dropping their things, running away from the group itself, trying to hide, and also actually in many cases that we've heard of people saying, I ran to hide to attempt to protect myself from the blades of the helicopter or of the weight of the helicopter, because that's how close the helicopters are coming in contact with humans. And so when that happens, normally once the helicopter leaves, because the helicopter does not land to actually act in the apprehension, the helicopter leaves after a while. People then very quickly try and pick up what they have and leave that scene before the helicopter returns. So this results in slower moving people, including young people or the very old, the sick, the injured, being left behind in the chaos and alone in the backcountry. It means that people are being separated from the person in the group who would be referred to as the guide, who would know where they were going or even know where they were located in the first place. It means likely that they are being separated from resources or other family members in the group. And so this is just one of the tactics that we see and hear about repeatedly that results in people being disappeared into the wilderness of the border. Another thing that we hear a lot about from folks is just the violent nature of Border Patrol agents themselves. So escalated Border Patrol violence during apprehension is how we refer to that. We hear of people being assaulted by Border Patrol agents. One of our previous reports that came out in 2012 called The Culture of Cruelty, looked at this phenomena a little bit closer, looked at the actual number of, we interviewed many people, thousands of people actually, and heard their stories of how many times they were punched or kicked or pushed into cactus by Border Patrol or even held in stress positions. People have told us they've had appendages or their feet run over by Border Patrol vehicles. And so this kind of the culture of cruelty then creates sort of a like that is known by people who are crossing the border. And so they attempt to flee and not be caught into the cycle of violence during an interdiction with Border Patrol. They flee, and in that fleeing from the Border Patrol agent are often also injured. And so it's both the known violence of the agent and then the act of fleeing that can create dangerous situations for a person who is then scattered from their group and lost. So part one really looks at these deadly apprehension methods and how they contribute not to apprehensions themselves, not to actually people being apprehended, but that how they are contributing to the disappearance in the wilderness areas of the borderlands.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Kate Morgan. And Kate is a representative of No More Deaths, which is one of the groups, along with La Coalición de Derechos Humanos, who produced the report Disappeared, How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. Now, just so people can get clear on this, there was something in the report that really struck me very, very sharply. And that's when there's a lot of references to low-intensity war zones. It seems like there is a sort of a low-intensity war being waged against immigrant people trying to come into the country for whatever reason and desperately trying to cross over and going through, being willing to go through all this stuff. But there's actually a war being waged against these people, which I think a lot of people don't understand. They don't really get that this is a low-intensity war going on.
Yeah, and we use that term also just to refer to almost like, it's hard to describe the feeling of the borderlands. It really is something, if you haven't been to the border zone, we really encourage people to come witness what Arizona looks like, because the proliferation of surveillance towers, drones, agents on foot, agents on horseback, agents on ATV, trucks, those things, I think people really think of like, they think tend to think of like the wall, the physical wall themselves, but the wall is just sort of the aesthetic cover up for the 100-mile zone that looks like a war zone on the borderlands and feels like a war zone. Like the tension that is created around this militarization and the military presence of agents on the border is what we're referring to. And again, yes, it is definitely the reason why that infrastructure and those agents are here is to like manage or control the borderlands and against this so-called like onslaught of immigrants. But again, this is a border with countries that we actually have very friendly relationships to otherwise in the marketplace, right? Like NAFTA and TPP, the flow of goods over our border and the contracts that we have with corporations, both in Mexico and Central America, are quite friendly. It is when it comes to actually people and humanity in which the borderlands turns into a war zone.
Mm-hmm. But it's also very heavy, because when you look at things like, for instance, the fact that people are, that some of the things that you've already spoken about, where you talk about this thing of like the scattering of people, you know, which is really, when you're talking about people in a desert environment, people in a way, you know, when being scattered is actually a death sentence, you know, it's very difficult to, you know, for people who have no familiarity with the scene out there, where to go, how to survive it, suddenly are scattered and broken away from all the people that were actually with them and left to just wander around in the desert hoping to be able to survive. This is a really, I mean, not just cruel, but it's really an inhumane. It's actually, I would not hesitate to call these kinds of actions as crimes against humanity. You add in that and you look at, you know, scattering. You also look at the, you know, this question of, you know, the way that the physical violence that you've spoken about in terms of what the Border Patrol does to the people that they encounter. If they're not scattering them, if they're not beating the hell out of them, What happens? I mean, this is something I think people need to understand, the ferocity of this and what difference it makes in terms of the robbing the people who are trying to come into the country, robbing them of their humanity, and actually, in many cases, just ending up dead with, you know, it's a deadly direction that things go in. And many people do, in fact, disappear. Many people do die as a result of all this. This is something that I don't think a lot of people really understand, the cruelty involved in this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we are talking more about what the terrain is like and how deadly it is and how all of the agents and border enforcement strategies are contributing to the disappearance, I do want to name one particular policy, which is prevention through deterrence. Prevention through deterrence is an official policy of the U.S. government. And it was enacted in 1994, the same time that NAFTA happened. So the same time that we see pieces of the border wall going up is the same time that we know that more commerce is going to be conducted across the U.S.-Mexico border. And during that time, as the wall starts going up in urban areas, the reason is because of prevention through deterrence, the stated logic of which is that if you can make the journey as deadly, as traumatic, as horrible as possible, that people will not attempt to make it. And of course, we know this logic to be very flawed. This goes back to my point before, which is that people have very compelling reasons to leave and make such a long and deadly journey. And so prevention through deterrence actually doesn't result in fewer people crossing. It results in more people dying. It results in more people being forced into wilderness terrains where there's very few humans for them to come into contact with if they actually were in trouble and needed help, very few natural occurring water sources, and temperatures that in Arizona we see, you know, temperatures can be 120 in the summer and it can snow in the winter. So it's a terrain that is very extreme, and it is weaponized essentially by the U.S. government against people who will be crossing the border, resulting in a crisis of death and disappearance.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have just a couple more questions, and one I really want to get into. You can spend all the time you want on this one. The destruction of and interference with humanitarian aid, because there's a lot of people who, you know, really admire them, the people who go out into the desert and try to leave containers of water and other things that would actually help people survive if they're out in the desert trying to get across, trying to get into the country and whatnot. And there's actually a willful destruction and interference with the ability of people to actually both distribute that aid, but also of people to actually get access to it. This is actually, you know, when you look at it, this is a homicidal act.
Yeah, so part two of our report does look at the interference and destruction of humanitarian aid. And this is something that we've been trying to shed light on for many years. At first, it was just anecdotally saying, we're putting water out in the desert. People are destroying it either by shooting it, slashing it, stomping it, kicking it, confiscating it. We believe it's Border Patrol, and people saying, what do you mean you think it's, you know, law enforcement? That can't be. Give us proof. So then we moved in like 2011, I guess, we started setting up trail cams at some of the water drop caches that were being vandalized repeatedly. And we actually caught instances of Border Patrol agents kicking our water gallons and confiscating blankets. And that did run, and we took it to Border Patrol, the sector chief at that time. He said that he would look into it. We asked if there were any disciplinary measures taken against those agents later on. They told us the official policy is that they don't release any information on discipline against the agents. Those agents were seen in the field later, so we presume that no discipline was taken against them. And it persisted. The vandalism persisted. And people continued to question whether it was just, quote unquote, you know, a few bad apples, or if it was, as we said, which was that we believed that people were encouraging each other to take these acts against our water drops. And so we said, fine, we'll do a quantitative analysis. We'll give you the statistics on it. And we looked at the data that we had on water gallons and where they were left, where they were vandalized, and how frequently. We looked at the study period that we look at ranges from 2012 through 2015. And during that time, we distributed over 31,000 gallon jugs of water to migrant trails in southern Arizona. And what we found was that there was water gallons vandalized a total of 415 times, so on an average at least two times a week during that study period, and that overall more than 3,000 gallons of water jugs were vandalized in the approximately 800 square mile desert corridor area that we work in. And when we looked at the land jurisdictions that 800 square mile corridor covers, we found that there's a lot of different actors in a lot of different jurisdictions, you know, BLM land, ranch land, parks and rec land, and the only actor that had the ability to be consistently accessing all these land jurisdictions year after year after year is Border Patrol. And so along with the statistical analysis, our own eyewitness accounts, and also the trail cams, we encourage people to believe us when we say that U.S. law enforcement is a primary, perhaps not the only, definitely not the only actor, but a primary actor in the destruction of humanitarian aid supplies in this very deadly wilderness corridor. And that's something that's really important to remember, is that the acts of chasing and scattering, forcing people into wilderness area, then chasing and scattering them so that they don't have access to resources, and then eliminating the few resources that they might encounter, yes, it's a deadly act.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more question for you. You have, you know, at the end of your report, you have a, basically you spend a lot of time on talking about what is to be done, the list of demands. And I thought it was really important for people to understand this, because you frame them in a way that actually, again, intensifies people's understanding of what's happening to people who are trying to, you know, come into this country in order to even to save their own lives, or to be able to help save their families back home, whatever. You know, for whatever reason people are coming in, they are being systematically destroyed in one way or another. And you folks have not only done this really important report, but you've also, at the end of it, You've stated a list of demands, which I thought it would be important for people to understand or hear a little bit about those demands, what they are, and take it away.
Okay. So one of our demands is simply that there actually is an investigation into agents who are destroying water gallons, and that there is a known disciplinary measure for interacting with agents who are caught interfering with aid. We also ask that we ask for international organizations such as the United Nations to investigate the abuse and the forms of violence that are being used by the U.S. Border Patrol against migrants. We believe that the kind of violence that we're seeing, the death and disappearance, does constitute crimes against humanity. And we want people at an international level to be paying attention to what's happening on the U.S. border. And we also are asking, actually, for reparations for the families of the disappeared and the deceased. We believe that the loss of life that's happening on the border is intentional, and it's being caused by the U.S. government. And we believe that the U.S. government should be accountable for those acts and for the deaths and disappearance of people. And particularly in the case of the disappeared, where people are actually never able to bury a loved one, the reverberations of that trauma, the echo throughout communities and families, when a person dies and there's no way to, you know, to like, there's no way for that person's ability. I mean, I hate to like tie someone's life to capital, but many times the people who are crossing are the primary breadwinners in a family. And so their death or their disappearance, not only is it traumatic, but it actually is materially important and materially traumatic as well as psychologically traumatic. And when it is due to U.S. government policies, we believe that those actors, those agencies, should be accountable to the families in the very least in a material way and pay reparations to the families.
Mm-hmm. Now, just one more thing, just in closing here, You've obviously spent a lot of time, a lot of your heart is into this. You know, I'd really like to, it's an extremely important thing, and I'd really like you to leave people with something, just something from yourself, from your own heart about what is it, what makes you do this, and why is it so damn important for people to wake up and pay attention and put a stop to this horror that's going on?
I think this is what's happening on the U.S. border. You know, someone listening to me speak about it might feel anger or rage or frustration or sadness about what's happening on the border. And I certainly feel those feelings too, but it is being here every day and witnessing the consequences of the border, witnessing the acts of Border Patrol agents and the U.S. government. And being here, it's such a visceral experience. It's an experience that has changed my life, and it's one of those experiences that I felt like once I knew it, I couldn't unknow it. And I don't necessarily like identify with the U.S. government, but I acknowledge that I live in this country, and as a white middle class college educated citizen of the United States, I have a lot of privileges that mean that my family and my community is not being impacted by these policies the same way other people's. And I felt like I wanted to be here to use my privileges and to witness and to act in a way in solidarity with people who were experiencing this kind of violence. And that, again, was something that was drawn out of me from being here on the borderlands and seeing the consequences of what were happening and feeling it so deeply in my heart that I felt like this is where I wanted to stand, this was the place that I wanted to be, and these were communities who I wanted to be in solidarity with.
Mm-hmm. Very, very important. One more thing, I lied. One more thing. Where can people get in touch with the organizations? Where can they get a copy of this report?
Yeah, so if folks want to read more about the report, they should visit the website, thedisappearedreport.org. And there you'll be able to download the report itself and read more of our fact sheets, see some of the materials that we published. You can also follow nomoredeaths.org to find out more information on the organization itself or to get involved as a volunteer.
All right, Kate. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
That brings us to the end of yet another show. I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and engineer, Gary Baca. And each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. That's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
One, two, and brothers, 'cause if you do